Time to check in with our media critic, Dick Weiss. You can find him at weissright.com. That's W-E-I-S-S, weissright.com. Or you can go to stlbeacon.org, a longtime editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and he's soon to be our longtime media critic here. Good morning this morning.
Good morning.
Have a nice Thanksgiving.
I did, and I am sitting here at 98.6 degrees above zero.
That's because we like to...
That guy last hour, he will never be married. I can safely predict. I don't care how good-looking he is. He will not ever get married.
So let me guess. At the Weiss household, there's been some conversations about what the temperature is.
It goes up. It goes down. It remains safely in between 68 and 72, I would say.
Now, my grandfather, God rest his soul, was, shall we say, frugal? Mm-hmm. So much so that he would like to walk into rooms and turn lights off to save electricity, right?
Absolutely.
Even if you were using the lights,
right? My wife's like that. She constantly plunges me into darkness.
Now, my grandfather was so frugal, if you will, that he would lower the sound on the television because he thought it would use less electricity. Now, that's frugal.
Yes.
All right. So we all read Maureen Dowd's column on Sunday.
Yes.
And we all thought to ourselves, well, this is the end of newspapers as
this
we know
is,
it.
Yes, as we know it. A online website, news website in Pasadena, California, run by a guy by the name of James McPherson. McPherson fired 7 of his local staffers, including 5 reporters, who were making $600, $800 a week. A hefty, salary.
Right.
Almost as much as yours. And they now direct 6 employees from India who cover Pasadena by press release, by local access cable, and so on. And they, he says they do a fine job. Now, they have sometimes a little trouble kind of understanding the local situation. Say, you know, in Pasadena is the Rose Bowl. And the one of the reporters that Maureen Dowd interviewed said that he had a little trouble understanding exactly what the Rose Bowl was. He thought it was it had something to do with cooking. I would think they'd say,
but
floral in some way. But I guess he had the bowl,
right? Okay, but to put this into explain this a little better, a news gathering organization newspaper had a newspaper based in Pasadena sold to Pasadena residents about mm-hmm. Pasadena.
Right. Well, it's all just online. It's not in print.
But all of the reporters are based in India.
Yeah, they're covered by phone, by TV, by and press releases, and they get paid $7.50 for 1,000 words. Now, 1,000 words is a fairly hefty article. That's that's slightly longer than a Bill McClellan column.
Okay, so, and the people of Pasadena have no problem going and reading this. It's still going strong.
Well, I don't know if they have a problem or not. We haven't actually heard from the readers, but the guy is making a profit. He's running a successful business.
Right.
So, apparently, he has some advertising and he has some readers. So.
Now, he was highly criticized when this first happened a few years ago, but has since been vindicated, so says Maureen Dowd.
Yeah. So,
I mean, wasn't there a mainstream newspaper who came out and said, hey, anything you can ship overseas to save money, the better.
Right. And that conference I mentioned last week at the American Press Institute, where publishers were gathered in a crisis atmosphere, they were talking about outsourcing things and combining copy desks. If you have newspapers all over the country and your stuff needs to be copy edited, you send it to one place for the stuff. Now, what you'll lose is, we know that it's Olive Boulevard in West County and Olive Street Road and certain places. And your universal copy desk based in Detroit or Timbuktu or Thailand or wherever it may not know those things. But they're talking about doing that, combining those resources, saving money.
Right, and I'm all for saving money. And, business changes, so shall the business. But if you had a universal... if Lee Enterprises, for example, the Post-Dispatch newspaper here in town, had a universal desk, say, in Detroit, somebody from St. Louis could move to Detroit who knew the local flair, right, who could sit at that desk and do whatever it is you need to do.
You could do that.
And you save on all the other duplicate cost savings there or whatever.
Right.
So speaking of Lee Enterprises, not doing so well, is it?
Yeah, today I just checked, selling for 93 cents. And if you are, as I understand it, if you are under $1.05 for 30 days in a row, you can be delisted from the New York Stock Exchange,
right,
where Lee exists. So that's not a good thing. The stock has been going down, with just a few blips here and there, back up.
But Lee's making money. They still say they're making money.
Yeah, and they're making money on the Post-Dispatch is still in the black. The problem is that the trends are not good, and the fact that Lee has a tremendous debt, they had to renegotiate with their creditors, and that is based on some assumptions. And if those assumptions don't come to pass in the next year or so, then things will become even more dire. I would, looking at the trends and reading the analysts, they're all predicting that more cuts are in the offing for newspaper chains, likely that it's not over yet. And as you know, we already went through some cuts.
Right. What about circulation-wise?
Last report was they were holding steady on Sunday and down, I think, about 9% year over year on the daily circulation.
You have a stat here. 18% of Americans buy daily newspapers now, as opposed to 36%?
Yeah, 1945, when newspapers were in their heyday. What's that figure I gave you,
36%.
36%, and now it is just 18%. Clearly, Americans are just getting out of the habit of buying a daily newspaper and having that as their first resource of news. It is still, however, if you just watch cable television and other sources of online fodder, there so many of your ideas come from the national papers,
right,
Washington Times, the LA Times, the New York Times. The New York Times did an interesting piece on car dealers. And suddenly this morning you turn on the cable TV, and they're all doing car dealer stories.
Right.
A fairly obvious story to do, but nonetheless, they were using the New York Times as what we call a copy, background, that informed their reports. So we need the daily newspaper.
If you look at the national stories, the ones that the people will be talking about tomorrow, the next day, and the next day, they come from the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Drudge, and Huffington Post. Those five drive the conversation, and you're right. You turn on any, I don't care, liberal, conservative, they all have their own spin on whatever story, but the fact is the story and the idea comes from those, I'd say,
right,
80% of the other time come from those,
right,
five sources.
The New York Times and the other outlets you mentioned are a kind of an intellectual resource for the nation, and it's gotten to the point where that resource is becoming thinner and thinner, and in a way less diverse. I think when JR was here, he mentioned how many Pulitzer Prize winners no longer work for newspapers.
Right.
And that's as you lose that, you're going to lose a source of great ideas and good reporting.
Well, but I also think that if you read the New York Times, you're not an elitist. You're not somebody who's, you don't think you're smarter than the rest of the people. You just like to read a good, interesting story, right?
Yeah, right? Terrific writing.
Right. Whether you are conservative or liberal, they still have 1,000 things in there that have nothing to do with
politics,
party affiliation.
Right, right.
It's just interesting stuff.
It's just provocative.
Right.
And it makes you think.
Yeah. What about, there's something else I wanted to ask you in that regard. They say 18% of Americans now buy daily newspapers. It isn't that I don't think people aren't reading the news.
They're reading
it.
They're crazy to read.
Right.
Yeah, it's no question about that. And they're reading. The other industry that's hard hit is the book publishing industry, because people are on the internet so often now, and their attention spans have been reduced to like gnats.
Right.
And people can hardly sit down now with a book and go cover to cover. We talked about this before. I had that problem myself. is that I'm just flitting from one thing to the next, and there's so much interesting stuff out there. So
right.
People are reading.
Yeah, people are reading, and they're reading online, and, and they're finding different news sources. So even though they're not reading newspapers, it isn't like the American people is half as informed as they were back in 1946. Yeah. I would say they're more informed today than they've ever been.
What I wonder about, I don't think I've seen any studies on this, is whether they're reading, I guess what I would call original enterprise material, or are we reading just more and more commentary on material that is just sort of validating our opinions,
right?
Or maybe sometimes we like to have our opinions challenged, but it's basically commentary on something that's been dug up. What you find in books, even in in novels, is original ideas, and in nonfiction, stuff that's been really well researched and considered and thought about. And I'd be interested in
How much publishers will tell you. That it is very difficult to sell fiction.
Right.
Fiction just does not sell. Nonfiction sells.
Right.
Fiction, it's almost impossible.
But then you got what kind of nonfiction? Didn't I see that Glenn Beck has the best-selling some Christmas story he wrote?
Oh, the Christmas sweater?
Yeah, is that fiction or nonfiction?
I don't know. But that's a little different.
And Marley and Me,
which is nonfiction. But Glenn Beck is a famous writer,
right.
so he has a built-in audience.
Right.
So that's not.
There's so many books that's the books that seem to sell well are that you're famous first,
right.
And then you write something,
right.
From Tom Brokaw,
right, as a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this Mary Poles, this movie critic.
Mary Poles. Well. This sounds to me like a kind of a bid. This is one of those people who took a buyout. She was with the Contra Costa Times, and she started commiserating with another guy who was considering taking the buyout. And next thing you know, they're in the back seat and having what she called buyout sex, and which is what happens, But then she blogs about it, and then it.
Wait a minute! Hold on a second. Back up a second. She had buyout sex, and you say it happens. Do you have any? Do you have any experience in this?
I would just say that people under in a stressful situation.
Okay,
and with a few drinks in them.
Okay,
you would think.
So
I have no personal knowledge.
You have no personal knowledge, and you have no knowledge of other coworkers going through buyout sex.
I don't think I do. Actually, I don't want to sound any more knowledgeable than I am.
Okay,
actually. But anyway, so she blogs about it, and then she the New York Times writes about it. And so Mary has, I think, probably made a name for herself and probably can start got a good launch on her career post the newspaper.
Post buyout sex.
Yeah, post buyout. So she, I think, if I were looking into motives, I'd say Mary was just using this little adventure that she had with this guy as a way of launching a new career for herself. Now, she was apparently a well-regarded critic, and it's interesting because the guy stayed at the paper. He didn't take the buyout. And
so he wasn't having buyout sex.
No, actually, he got even more buyout sex. He went on to other women. So they kind of broke up afterwards. Interesting tale.
How about that? All right. So there's a couple of things I want to get to here. What's the best story we've never read?
Okay. There was a fairly sensational killing a few years ago in New York City. A guy by the name of Mark Fisher was found shot to death. His body was splayed on the sidewalk and his face and chest riddled with bullets. And they caught a couple of guys who apparently, it was just sort of after, an encounter at a bar, and they caught a couple of guys, and one of the guys was John Giuca, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who was convicted and sentenced to 25 years for the slaying. His mother always thought that, Giuca's mother always thought that he was innocent, and she went out to try to prove that he was, so she undercover, on her own, started consorting with a juror, looked him up, found out where he lived, and dressed herself up. And there's a picture of her, McGraw. I'm going to just show it to you at a distance here.
Right.
And she is what you would call hot.
Right.
Even though she's 46. I don't want to insult anybody that's 46. I'm sure there are a lot of hot 46-year-olds. But she's really,
okay,
really good looking.
Right.
And so she wooed him and got him to talk about his experience as a juror. And apparently he confessed that he knew some of the people that were involved in the case, which is a no-no for
right.
the juror. She gets all this recorded, and she's trying to get a new trial for her son.
Wow.
So,
and where are we? She's in the process of trying to get a new trial.
Yeah, she's got the information. She's turned over to the authorities. As I read the story, I'm kind of doubt that she's going to be able to spring him, but a very interesting story about a mom who's very passionate about getting her son out of prison.
And that's in Vanity Fair.
That's in Vanity Fair. It's also written about the New York Times.
And you can
get it at the website.
Weisright.com. Yeah. All right. What's going on with the Beacon?
In the Beacon, the 70th anniversary of the Evening World. Do you get that paper?
The Evening World. Dr. Ron makes sure he puts that in my mailbox every
right?
week. Yes.
Well, apparently, the Evening World is a sensational local crime rag, and it often have rhyming headlines and frequently convict the people before they're,
yes.
they're brought to trial.
Yes.
In the way in which they write about them.
Is it an African American newspaper?
Yeah, it's founded by an African American,
okay.
Ben Thomas, and now it's in he's passed on, and now it's in the hands of another publisher who is I'm according to this article in the Beacon has improved the production values of the paper. Now here, this is still paper ink on print,
right?
Ink on paper that is, I guess, doing well, survived 70 years old.
Now, I know that the Shadow, their behind-the-scenes private, unknown columnist used to call me a racist every week.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. But I did see recently that Ed Martin, former chief of staff for Governor Blunt, is now... has a mini column in that Evening
oh,
World?
Oh, yeah, I did not know.
I don't know if it was a guest column or if
Boy,
this is
strange,
a weekly...
Strange bedfellows. There.
Right, if yeah. this is a weekly thing or not. But yeah. The Evening World turns...
Read about the Evening World in the St. Louis Beacon.
Turned 70. And
org.
What are you doing at the Press Club?
Yeah, Press Club, Thursday, December 5th, our annual meeting at which Julius Hunter will hold forth on his book. Have you had him on?
I've had Julius Hunter on when the first book came out.
Okay, he's got a new book called TV One-on-One, and great encounters with presidents and personalities, and the one story I'm looking forward to hearing him talk about is his encounter, which my mother was involved in, with Sophia Loren, in which he and two other reporters just fell all over themselves with Sophia. And I'm proud to say I will be installed as president of the Press Club this year.
Mm-hmm.
And
Maybe you could have Press Club president sex.
It's a good thing I'm going before Barack Obama and not after.
All right.
Tough act to follow.
That's December 5th.
Yes.
Where can we get tickets?
It's go to stlpressclub.org. And you can pay with credit card, pay online, and it's at 8:30, December 5th. It's a breakfast thing at Logan College of Chiropractic.
Yeah, sure, out there right off
Purser
of
Center.
Highway 40.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Dick Weiss, media critic, weissright.com. Thanks. We'll talk to you next Monday.
Okay.